Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So how do you survive the so-called holiday season if you don't celebrate the holidays? We've got a question page on our website, and we'll take your calls on this in about an hour. How do you survive the so-called holiday season if you don't celebrate the holidays? Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, secularists, anyone who doesn't celebrate Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, post to our question page, how do you survive the so-called holiday season if you don't celebrate the holidays? And we'll talk about it on the air next hour. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. But something much more serious to begin today. The defendants were five Muslim immigrants from three different countries, Albania, Turkey, and Jordan. Yesterday, a federal jury in New Jersey found them guilty of plotting to attack Fort Dix. They were acquitted of attempted murder since they did not carry out their idea. They did not apparently have a specific plan, from what I've read. Time magazine says the conviction proves that the government can convince a jury to support the idea of a preemptive prosecution against potential terrorists. Much of the Muslim community considers this a case of entrapment, with two government informants goading the men on when they had no real plot, they say. But the ruling sets an important legal precedent for when the government can preemptively prosecute people for dreaming up terrorist plots without taking any action to carry them out. And this was a case in open court. This was not a Dick Cheney special before a military tribunal with secret evidence. Let's get some legal analysis from Karen Greenberg from the Center on Law and Security at NYU. Then we'll get some community reaction from Jim Suess from the Council on American Islamic Relations. Karen Greenberg, welcome to WNYC. Hi there.
Hi.
What were the defendants actually found to have done? How far did this plot go, according to the jury?
I think, according to the jury, this plot in this case, specifically when compared to other cases, went further than ones we've seen come through the system in that they attempted to purchase weapons. And I think that given the entrapment defense, et cetera, that just was couldn't get around the fact that they had gone that extra step, and of course that they had that the prosecution was able to convince the jury that the having possession of maps was also a sign of the conspiracy. So I think in this case, when you're talking about preemptive justice, yes, the FBI has been trying to fight these cases this way since 9/11. But in this case, it's not just preemptive incitement. It's not just declarations of protest and expressions of jihad. It was actually the attempt to purchase automatic weapons.
And we'll talk more about the entrapment or alleged entrapment element of the case when Jim Suess gets here, because I know he has some thoughts on that. But what precedents do you think this case sets? How does it advance the law of preventive prosecution?
Well, I'm not really sure, because what it does is advance the case of the Department of Justice being able to get some convictions on grounds that they can prove as opposed to grounds that they are alleging. And what you referred to in your introduction is sort of a kind of fantasy sense of what's going on in the world. I mean, in this particular case, they didn't charge them with any terrorism charge, which is the case in most alleged terrorism cases. They didn't prove any ties to al-Qaeda or to any FTO, foreign terrorist organization.
They didn't allege any, correct?
Correct. And what they said was that these guys could self-proclaim their ideas to be something that al-Qaeda might sponsor. But there was no sense that these guys were tied to a foreign terrorist organization of any sort. And I think that weakened the case as well. And so as a precedent, it's only a strong case in that they got the conviction and in that these guys tried to buy weapons. And going forward, unless they're going to have I think the weapons thing is dispositive. And I think you also have to consider the context in which this is taking place, which is several weeks after the Mumbai attacks, which has been brought up in the discussion of this case. And so I think it was a combination of timing, of prior cases that have been very weak. And so this case, compared to those cases, was weak. Compared to, let's say, the airline plot in London that was tried several months ago, this would not be considered a strong case.
We can take your phone calls and web comments on this at 212-433-WNYC. Have you been following the Fort Dix case or have any reaction to the news reports in the last day? 212-433-WNYC. Do you think this is important for good or for ill? Or any questions you have from Karen Greenberg, who's been following the case from the Center on Law and Security at the NYU Law School, where she's the executive director of that center. Center, by the way, just published its annual terrorist trial report card. So we'll put this in the context of that as we go along. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Our comments page is always open. Did they make the connection between the attempt to purchase weapons and the plot to attack soldiers at Fort Dix? In other words, were they able to establish, as a matter of fact in the court, that the defendants were buying the weapons to launch an attack on Fort Dix?
That was, I mean, when you say, you know, was it established as a fact, I mean, I think this is what they convinced the jury of, whether or not they can, you know, connected the dots in a perfect way, which they did not. But again, the issue here is that, think about it, they were accused of attempting to kill soldiers. We don't have a precedent for this case in the 620-plus cases that we've seen come through the system since 9/11. And I think that also plays a part here. This wasn't about an attack on the civilians, which is how we normally think of terrorism cases.
Well, that goes to the definition of terrorism, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Because if somebody feels that they're at war with the country and trying to attack soldiers, I mean, it still may be attempted murder, but is it terrorism, as
well,
we usually think?
That's exactly right. And now you're getting to the heart of how these cases have come down the pike. What's happened is that they've been alleged terrorism cases in the way the press follows them and the way the Department of Justice may describe them. But whether or not they are charged with terrorism crimes is another thing, you know, actual charges of terrorism. And so in this case, again, they didn't. And that is something to pay attention to in terms of a precedent, because they aren't able to take that extra step. And I do think in this case it did have something to do with the fact that it was about a military base and military personnel, soldiers.
How could they have charged them with attempted murder if they didn't actually try to kill anybody, take the weapon somewhere, even obtain the weapon successfully?
I'm not sure I quite understand the
question. There was a charge of attempted murder, correct?
Right.
And they were acquitted of that charge.
Exactly.
What was the argument for the charge? Did they ever successfully obtain the weapons?
They didn't. They were intercepted and arrested at the point of you know, being about to purchase the weapons, which brings up another part of the story, which we haven't really talked about, which is that the FBI seemed to have a little more patience in this case than it has had in other cases, where they sometimes have described themselves or others have described them as arresting very quickly upon some very meager suspicions of terrorism plots, terrorism cells. In this case, they were willing to let the informants go and to amass a little more evidence and to give a little bit of leash to the alleged terrorists or the alleged suspects, and caught them in the act of trying to purchase these weapons. And this is a dispute that the American Justice Department has had with justice departments elsewhere, particularly in Europe, in terms of how quickly do you intervene. Because if you want to establish a case, you need to let it play itself out a little bit. And our FBI has been somewhat reluctant to do this over the course of the past 7 years. And so that's another interesting part of this case that will be likely some kind of precedent.
Also joining us now is Jim Suess, Executive Director of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Jim Suess, welcome to WNYC, and you're on with Karen Greenberg from the Center on Law and Security at NYU. Hello.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's the New Jersey chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Great. I understand that you're concerned about this having been a case of entrapment. How far does that concern go?
Well, I did sit in on a couple of days of testimony, and I've read a lot of the newspaper account. And there was a very active role, frankly, being played by the informant in this case. I mean, the informant was not a fly on the wall taking notes.
You want to describe it?
Describe which?
The role of the informant?
Oh, well, the informant was essentially pressing the defendants to buy weapons, to conduct meetings, to acquire maps. I mean, basically, the various you know, actions that they took in support of any kind of a conspiracy were being pressed by the informant.
Karen Greenberg?
I think that's correct. I mean, I think that the real question here is how much did the informant, you know, lead, or how much did the informant observe what was going on? And this has been a running theme, gaining steam in the past several years of terrorism-related cases in the United States. But to put it in context, even in organized crime situations, let's say, the breadth that the informant is given in which to sort of do more than observe is much broader than we would otherwise think. So that doesn't make it not a problem and not something to look at. But the informants have been used in a number of disappointing ways throughout terrorism cases. And then this one, the line seemed to convince the jury that it wasn't as questionable as in cases like Lodi in California. Or
what happened? Give us some examples there. What happened in Lodi that would lead you to call it disappointing? And what was different here?
Well, Lodi, and then there's also the closer Albany case, be interested in other opinions on this. But in the Albany case, if you read through the FBI transcripts, which are available, the FBI informant keeps coming back and keeps saying, you know, do you agree with me about jihad? Do you, can I get you to give me this loan because I want to purchase weapons with it? And eventually, over a long period of time, he gets what he wants. And so, again, in the broader definition of entrapment through the courts, it might not be entrapment. For those of us who are standing on the outside watching, it feels unfair, and it feels as if he was leading these people on and saying, you know, could I get you to participate in a scheme of terrorism? And that is problematic. Terrorism cases, are different than other cases, and we were trying to find our way towards what that is. In this case, they had two informants. In the New Jersey case, the Fort Dix case, they had two informants. And I'm not sure if that didn't strengthen the case because the credibility of the informant is everything. The credibility of the informant was under much scrutiny in Lodi. And, you know, one of the stories about Lodi is that the defense had testimony from other FBI, former FBI agents, who were questioning what the informants had done and how the interrogations had taken place. And that evidence wasn't allowed. That testimony wasn't allowed in. So the problem of the informants has been consistent and growing throughout the terrorism cases since 9/11. But in this one, it seemed to have less problems than in Lodi or in Albany and in other places.
So, Jim Suze, do you question the correctness of the convictions fundamentally? Before you came on, Karen was saying that ultimately what was dispositive for the jury apparently was that the defendants did actually attempt to purchase weapons after they had talked about attacking soldiers at Fort Dix.
Well, yeah, I'm not even sure that that's the case, to tell you the truth, because there were five defendants. One of them talked to the informant about attacking Fort Dix, and they actually conducted some surveillance on Fort Dix and other forts. He was not involved in the purchase of weapons, and he didn't even know weapons were being purchased. The defendants that bought weapons were not proven to be aware that Fort Dix was being discussed.
Huh?
Yeah, it's all there. So there was no plot in the sense that there were these five defendants talking amongst themselves about attacking anything.
You agree with that, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the prosecution successfully left the line, left you to connect the dots for yourself if you were on the jury, and that they did it in a way that was successful. I still think that because of the weapons and because of the presence of the maps, though this distinguishes this case from other cases, because we have not had terrorism cases in this country where we've been able to show that anybody was in the midst of making a transaction for automatic weapons. And it's that, you know, my take on this is that that made a huge difference, whether or not they connected the dots in a complete way. But, you know, That's just my opinion.
Jim?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the problem is that again, the people that purchased the weapons did not specifically say at any point that these are going to be used to attack Fort Dix or attack anybody. They were fond of target practice in the Poconos. And in fact, they had made statements to the effect that these were for the sake of shooting in the Poconos. So the problem that I have with the whole thing is the government is painting this as a plot that was underway, that was uncovered. I don't think that there was a plot that was uncovered. I think that this is a plot that was essentially drawn out by the informant himself, and the five were connected by the informant himself. They knew each other. They were friends. As a matter of fact, the defendant that went on the surveillance trips of Fort Dix claimed that the other ones would be involved. But the other defendants in that never actually were involved in any discussions that specifically of Fort Dix or any other specific attack. But again, that goes back to the legal definition of conspiracy. They don't have to have a specific plan, which is, I think, what really tied the noose for these defendants.
We have a few more minutes on the Fort Dix conspiracy convictions with Jim Suess, Executive Director of the New Jersey Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at the NYU Law School, and Hussein in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Hussein. Hussein, Hello. Do we have you?
Hello.
Hello, Hussein. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Actually, I want to comment, if Mr. Bryan allow me, about the comments about informer and entrapper.
The difference between informant and entrapment?
No, it has been already addressed, so kind of you. I want to give them some ground realities that how these innocent people, they are entrapped. I belong to the same community, sir, so I know a little bit that how these individuals who are law-abiding citizens, how they become terrorists.
So tell us how, as you see it.
Sir, for example, these young children, for example, take the terrorist who killed so many people in Bombay. According to India Abroad, that is a paper on record. I respect them. This gentleman and, this person and his friend, he went to Lashkar-e-Tayyiba to learn how to use weapons. They want to commit a dacoity or robbery in Pakistan. So what happened there, I don't know. Take in this country, one gentleman, he is probably 19 years old. I never involved myself physically in anything, but I read a lot.
Hussein, I have to leave it there for time. Thank you for your call. Jim Suess, what do you think the ramifications will be of this decision for the various Muslim and immigrant communities, Turkish, Jordanian, Albanian, from which the defendants come?
Well, I mean, there has been sort of a lingering cynicism about the fairness and justice of that the system will afford Muslims, and I think that this is going to impact it in a negative way. I think that Muslims are also going to be a bit more suspicious about what surveillance tactics might be in place, and they'll be pretty careful about what they say, just about wherever they are.
You know, a lot of listeners would be thinking, well, if someone comes up to you, whether you suspect that they're an informant or not, and arranges for you to buy automatic weapons, just say no.
Yeah, which is thankfully not a bad outcome, but It does sort of, again, lend to the cynicism about the system.
Maria in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello, Maria.
Yeah, hi. Very interesting stuff. And, you know, this is extremely troubling, I think. We have given the government a lot of latitude since 9/11, and instead of relying on the protections that the Constitution already affords, we've tried to invent new ways here. And if you give the authority, it will be used. So where does it stop? I mean, you know, people who are reporters, if I can think of all kinds of different types of people who would start trying to get information and then what, be arrested because you've got some guy who wants to be a novelist. I mean, I don't mean to give a ridiculous example, but who comes up with a plot idea. Writers do research. So you have somebody who starts doing research and starts uncovering some interesting things maybe about how security works. around a nuclear facility or what have you. I mean, does the government have the opportunity, it would appear yes, to arrest somebody for thinking about something? The purpose of what those thoughts are for may be completely secondary. And again, I don't mean to give a ridiculous example, but
right.
I am really concerned about this.
Well, Karen Greenberg, and we're almost out of time, how much do you think this is a case of that?
Well, what I think she's actually pointing to something very important, which goes beyond what she says. It's not worries about individuals being surveilled by the government, etc., but the lack of confidence in the Department of Justice to present a case that is clear and above board and that rings true with the American public, whether they're Muslims or non-Muslims. It has been compromised during this administration, and it is going to be one of the chief challenges of the Department of Justice under President Obama to resurrect some kind of confidence in our Justice Department when it comes to terrorism-related prosecutions. There's no question about it.
Jim Suh, the final word. We have 20 seconds.
No, I agree with that, that this does tend to add to the erosion of confidence in the system, that it's that, in fact, you will find justice for all.
At least this was a trial in open court. This was not a secret military tribunal with secret evidence. Do you think that mitigates the lack of trust in the system to some degree, Jim?
Well, frankly, I agree with you, it should. And again, I sat through some of the days of the trial, and it was a fair trial. I think that we do have a problem, though, frankly, with the role of the jurors, who are subjected to some rather emotion-stirring evidence that plays right into a lot of the emotions that have been stirred up by a lot of what they see in the media about Muslims and terrorists and these kinds of things. This does kind of lead to the question, can you actually find a fair and impartial jury in a case like this?
Jim Suh, Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, New Jersey Chapter. Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at the NYU Law School. Their terrorist trial report card for this year just out. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, where the jobs are in the recession, and then we'll look at why rental rates are more resistant to deflation than home buying prices. Stay with us.